A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been thinking about curiosity itself, which is essentially the founding principle of this whole show. He's asking why some people have wider intellectual interests than others. And then the bigger question, how do the specialists and the generalists fit together in a society, in specific jobs, to actually complement each other rather than just annoy each other? It's a good one. Gets at something I think about a lot.
And the way the prompt frames it, there's this unspoken tension, right? The prompt says, I'm probably high for intellectual curiosity, but I don't mean that in a superior way. That little disclaimer is doing a lot of work. It's acknowledging that curiosity has become a loaded word. Nobody wants to be called incurious. But we also know that deep expertise requires a kind of selective focus that can look a lot like incuriosity from the outside.
The surgeon who reads nothing but surgical journals and doesn't care about Roman history. Is that a character flaw, or is that the price of being the person you want operating on your spine?
And the research on this is genuinely fascinating. So let's start with the first part, why some people have wider intellectual interests. The personality psychology answer is pretty settled. The five-factor model of personality, which is the dominant framework, has this trait called openness to experience. And openness is basically the curiosity dimension. People high in openness are drawn to novelty, complexity, aesthetic experiences, intellectual exploration. They're the ones who hear about some obscure topic and think, tell me more, instead of, why would I need to know that?
This is heritable.
Twin studies put the heritability of openness at somewhere around 40-60%, depending on the study. There was a meta-analysis in behavior genetics a few years back that pegged it at about 57% for the shared environment component being quite small, less than 10% in adulthood, which means a big chunk of your baseline curiosity level is basically something you showed up with.
It's not just that some people had better kindergarten teachers who nurtured their wonder.
It's both, but the genetic component is stronger than most people assume. And there's a neurobiological layer here too. Dopamine is deeply involved in exploratory behavior and information seeking. People differ in dopamine receptor density and distribution, particularly in the prefrontal cortex and the striatum. Some brains are just more tuned to find novel information rewarding.
The person who spends their weekend reading about the history of salt production, their brain is literally getting a little dopamine hit from each new fact.
The brain processes novel information as a reward signal. And some people get a stronger reward signal from that than others. There's also what researchers call the information gap theory of curiosity. The idea that curiosity arises when you become aware of a gap between what you know and what you want to know. It's mildly aversive. You feel a tension, and satisfying your curiosity relieves that tension. But people differ in how large a gap they're willing to tolerate and how motivated they are to close it.
I've definitely known people who seem perfectly comfortable with enormous gaps in their knowledge. Not out of ignorance, just out of a kind of serene disinterest. I don't know how that works, and I'm fine with that.
That's not necessarily a flaw. That's the thing. If you're designing a society or a team, you don't want everyone to be the same on this dimension. Which brings us to the second part, how specialists and generalists fit together.
Before we get there, though, there's a piece I want to poke at. The prompt mentions countless advantages to being an expert within a narrow domain, and I think that's true. But there's also a cultural moment happening around this. The last decade or so has seen this backlash against the specialist, this veneration of the generalist. Range, the David Epstein book, that was a big deal. The idea that in a complex world, the people who can connect across domains are the ones who really add value.
There's truth to that, but we shouldn't overcorrect. The generalist narrative sometimes gets used as a comfort blanket by people who don't want to do the hard work of mastering anything. I'm not saying that's what the prompt is doing, but I've seen it. I'm a generalist can mean I have a rich intellectual life and can synthesize across domains, or it can mean I've never pushed past the beginner phase in anything. Those are not the same thing.
The shallow generalist versus the deep generalist.
The deep generalist has real expertise in at least one thing, and then breadth on top of that. They're not just sampling. They've experienced what it feels like to really know something deeply, and that shapes how they approach other domains.
Okay, so let's talk about how these types actually interact in the real world. Give me an example.
The classic case is academia. You have the hyperspecialists, the person who has spent 40 years studying in a single enzyme pathway or a single poet's early period, and they produce knowledge that nobody else could produce. They're the ones who notice the anomaly in the data, the thing that doesn't fit the current model, because they know the model so intimately.
The person who knows exactly where the bodies are buried in their subfield.
But then you need the synthesizers. The people who read across 5 subfields and notice that the anomaly in enzyme kinetics has a structural parallel to something happening in evolutionary biology and a methodological parallel to a debate in philosophy of science. The specialist might never see those connections because they don't read outside their lane. The generalist might never spot the anomaly in the first place because they don't know the data well enough.
The ideal is both. But in practice, how often does that actually work smoothly?
It depends enormously on the institutional structure. There was a really interesting study published in Nature a few years back. The researchers looked at scientific teams and their citation impact. They found that the highest impact papers tended to come from teams that combined deep specialists with a few broad synthesizers. Teams that were all specialists produced rigorous but incremental work. Teams that were all generalists produced interesting but sometimes sloppy work. The mixed teams hit the sweet spot.
That makes intuitive sense, but it's nice to see it in the data. What about outside of academia?
There's a parallel in product development. You need the engineer who knows one system so deeply they can optimize it to an almost absurd degree. The person who can squeeze another 20% performance out of a database query because they understand every layer of the stack. And you need the product thinker who understands enough about engineering, design, user psychology, and market dynamics to say we're optimizing the wrong thing entirely.
The classic tension between building the thing right and building the right thing.
And both are real forms of intelligence. The prompt mentions this, there's no superiority in being one type or the other. But organizations often reward one and undervalue the other. And which one gets rewarded depends a lot on the organization's stage and culture.
Say more about that.
Early stage startups tend to need and reward generalists. When you're figuring out what the product even is, you need people who can wear 5 hats. The engineer who can also talk to customers and design a landing page. As the company scales, specialization becomes more valuable. You need the person who does nothing but optimize the recommendation algorithm, because at scale, a 0.5% improvement is worth millions.
The generalists, who were heroes in the early days, often struggle in that environment. They feel like they're being pushed aside.
It's a well-known phenomenon. The startup to scale-up transition is brutal for the early generalists. Some of them adapt and specialize. They pick a lane and go deep. Others move on to the next early stage thing where their breadth is valuable again.
There's a life cycle dimension to this, but I want to zoom out even further. The prompt asks about how these types fit together to maximize societal benefits. That's a big question.
And I think one way to think about it is through the lens of what the philosopher Isaiah Berlin called the fox and the hedgehog. The fox knows many things, the hedgehog knows one big thing. Berlin borrowed this from the ancient Greek poet Archilochus, and he used it to categorize writers and thinkers. But it maps pretty cleanly onto our specialist-generalist distinction.
I've always been a little suspicious of that framework. It feels too binary.
Berlin himself acknowledged that. It's a spectrum, and most people are somewhere in the middle. But as a lens for thinking about how knowledge production works at a societal level, it's useful. Hedgehogs build depth. Foxes build connections. A healthy intellectual ecosystem needs both.
Here's what I wonder. Are we actually good at valuing both? Or does society have a bias toward one?
Historically, it swung back and forth. The 19th century had this ideal of the polymath, the person who could contribute to multiple fields. Humboldt, Goethe, people like that. The 20th century, especially after World War II, saw this massive push toward specialization. The rise of the research university, the professionalization of disciplines, the sense that real expertise meant narrower and narrower focus.
Now we're swinging back?
I think so, but with a twist. The pendulum isn't just swinging toward generalism, it's swinging toward a recognition that the most valuable intellectual work often happens at the intersections. The biologists who can program, the computer scientists who understand ethics, the historians who do network analysis.
The X plus Y person.
And this connects to something the prompt gestures at, the idea that wide-ranging perspective allows people to see connections between disparate topics. There's good cognitive science behind this. Creativity researchers talk about remote associates, the ability to connect ideas that are far apart in conceptual space. People with broader knowledge bases simply have more raw material for those connections.
The generalist isn't just a dabbler. They're someone whose cognitive architecture is set up to notice patterns across domains.
The specialist's cognitive architecture is set up to notice patterns within a domain that are invisible to outsiders. Both are pattern recognition, just at different scales.
Let me push on something. You mentioned earlier that curiosity has a genetic component. If openness is substantially heritable, and openness drives the generalist impulse, then to some degree we're talking about something people don't choose. The specialist isn't someone who decided to be narrow. They might just be lower in openness, more comfortable with deep familiar territory.
That's a really important point, and it should make us careful about moralizing this. The culture sometimes treats curiosity as a virtue and its absence as a failing. But if it's substantially heritable and neurobiologically grounded, that's like treating height as a virtue.
We don't say, oh, he's such a good person, he's 6'4".
Now, that said, curiosity can be cultivated. The heritability isn't 100%. Environment matters, especially in childhood. Exposure to diverse ideas, encouragement to ask questions, modeling of intellectual exploration by parents and teachers, all of that shapes how the genetic predisposition expresses itself.
There's also the question of domain. Someone might be intensely curious about one thing and completely incurious about everything else. Is that a generalist or a specialist?
That's a specialist with high curiosity in their domain. And those people are often incredibly productive. They're not incurious, they're just channeling all their curiosity into a narrow channel. Think of the mathematician who devours everything in their subfield but hasn't read a novel in 10 years. That's not a lack of curiosity. That's curiosity with a focus.
Which circles back to the prompt's question about how these types fit together. If you're building a team or a society, you probably want a mix of people whose curiosity is broad and people whose curiosity is deep.
And I think there's a specific mechanism by which they complement each other. The generalist often plays what I'd call a translation role. They can talk to the specialist in language the specialist understands, extract the key insight, and then re-express it in terms that another specialist from a different domain can grasp.
The generalist is API.
That's actually a great way to put it. The generalist provides the interface layer between specialist modules. Without that layer, the specialists talk past each other or don't talk at all.
In organizations, this translation role is often undervalued because it doesn't produce a discrete output. The specialist can point to the paper they published or the feature they shipped. The generalist translator's contribution is harder to measure. It's embedded in the quality of the collaboration.
There's a management theorist named Andrew Hargadon who wrote about this. He studied what he called technology brokers, people who moved between different engineering groups and carried ideas from one domain to another. He found that these brokers were disproportionately responsible for breakthrough innovations, not because they had the deepest expertise, but because they had the broadest exposure.
I love that. The idea that innovation often isn't about inventing something from scratch. It's about noticing that a solution from one domain maps onto a problem in another.
That's exactly the kind of thing a curious generalist does naturally. They're not trying to innovate. They just hear about something in domain A and think, huh, that sounds a lot like this problem in domain B.
If I'm running a research lab or a company, and I want to maximize this complementarity, what do I actually do? What's the practical takeaway?
A few things. One is, hire for both explicitly. Don't just hire specialists and hope they'll talk to each other. Hire at least a few people whose explicit role is to span boundaries. Give them permission to not be the deepest expert in any one thing.
Protect them from the performance review that says, what exactly do you do?
Because their impact will show up in the output of the specialist they connect, not in their own individual output. That requires a sophisticated approach to evaluating contribution. create structures that force interaction across domains. The physical layout of a building matters. There's that famous example from the MIT Building 20, the temporary structure that housed a wildly eclectic mix of researchers and produced an astonishing number of breakthroughs because people from completely different fields kept running into each other in the hallways.
The accidental collision theory of innovation.
It's not even that accidental. You can design for it. Shared coffee areas, cross-disciplinary seminars, internal conferences where people present to audiences outside their field. The key is to make cross-domain exposure the default rather than something people have to opt into.
On the individual level, if you're a specialist who wants to broaden, or a generalist who wants to deepen.
For the specialist, I'd say, follow your curiosity sideways. You don't have to become a generalist overnight. Just read one thing outside your field. Go to a talk in a different department. The goal isn't to become an expert in that other thing. It's to give your brain more raw material for those remote associations.
For the generalist,
pick one thing and go deeper than is comfortable. Just long enough to experience what real expertise feels like. Because there's a qualitative difference between knowing about something and knowing something. And until you've experienced that depth in at least one domain, you don't really understand what you're missing.
That's well put. There's a humility that comes from going deep. You realize how much you didn't know. You didn't know.
And that humility makes you a better generalist. You're less likely to overconfidently connect dots that don't actually connect.
Let me ask you something personal. You're a retired pediatrician who now spends his time reading research papers across a wildly broad range of topics and DJing on the side. Where do you put yourself on this spectrum?
I think I'm a specialist who got broad over time. The medical training was deep, years and years of focused specialization. But I was always reading outside the field, and once I retired from practice, the breadth just exploded. So I have that foundation of knowing what depth feels like, which I think makes me a better generalist now.
I put myself on the other side. I've always been broad, and I've had to consciously work at going deep on specific things. The podcast actually helps with that. It forces me to really sit with the topic rather than just grazing.
That's one of the things I love about doing this show. It's a structured way to push past the surface. We're both forced to actually engage.
The podcast itself is a kind of institutional design for curiosity, a mechanism for turning grazing into something more substantive.
That's a nice way to frame it. And it connects to the broader point about how you design environments to get the best out of both types. The show wouldn't work if we were both pure generalists. It would be shallow. It wouldn't work if we were both pure specialists. It would be narrow. The combination is what makes it work.
There's something almost dialectical about it. The specialist provides the thesis, the deep, rigorous understanding of a particular domain. The generalist provides the antithesis, the cross-domain connection, the reframing, the have you thought about it this way. And the synthesis is something neither could have produced alone.
That's Hegelian, but I'll allow it.
Generous of you.
Seriously, that dialectical model is actually a good description of how productive intellectual pairs work. Think of famous collaborations, Crick and Watson, Lennon and McCartney. Often you have one person who is the deep domain expert and one person who is the cross-pollinator, and the dynamic between them generates something new.
Though I'd push back slightly on the idea that these are fixed types. I think people can move between modes depending on the context. The same person might be a specialist in one setting and a generalist in another.
It's not a fixed identity. It's more like a cognitive style that can shift. And the best teams probably have people who can flex between modes.
What's the societal level takeaway here? The prompt asks how these types fit together to maximize societal benefits. If you were advising, say, an education minister or someone designing a national research strategy, what would you say?
I'd say a few things. First, stop treating specialization as the only path to seriousness. Our education systems, especially at the university level, push people toward narrower and narrower focus. The incentives all point that way. Publish in specialized journals, get known for one thing, build a career on a specific niche. That produces excellent specialists, but it also produces people who have never been trained to think broadly.
The counterpressure?
Create institutional support for breadth. Interdisciplinary research centers that are actually funded, not just announced in press releases. Grant mechanisms that reward synthesis and translation, not just original discovery within a discipline. Tenure criteria that value public engagement and cross-disciplinary work, not just field-specific publication counts.
It's a structural problem, not a talent problem.
The talent is there. The curious generalists exist. But they often get filtered out or forced to specialize because the structures don't support breadth. A curious person entering academia today either learns to narrow their focus or leaves.
That's bleak.
But it's also fixable. The structures are human-made. We can change them.
What about outside of academia? The broader culture?
I think we're actually in a better place culturally than institutionally. The internet, for all its flaws, has made broad curiosity much easier to satisfy. You can go down rabbit holes on anything. The problem is that it's mostly passive consumption rather than active synthesis. Reading 10 Wikipedia articles about different topics isn't the same as doing the work of connecting them.
The raw materials for generalist thinking are more available than ever, but the discipline of synthesis is still rare.
That's where things like this podcast come in. The value isn't just in the information, it's in modeling the process of connecting, showing what it looks like when someone says, "That reminds me of something from a completely different domain."
Which is essentially what intellectual curiosity is when it's functioning at its best. Not just collecting facts, but building a mental model that can accommodate facts from different domains and find the hidden structure connecting them.
And that's a skill that can be practiced. It's not just a personality trait.
We've covered the heritability, the neurobiology, the institutional design, the team dynamics. Is there anything we're missing?
One thing I want to touch on. The prompt mentions that being an expert in a narrow domain has countless advantages, and I think we should say more about what those advantages actually are, because they're not always obvious from the outside. Deep expertise gives you something that breadth alone can't. It gives you intuition. The specialist who has spent thousands of hours in a domain develops pattern recognition that operates below conscious awareness. They can look at a situation and just feel that something is off without being able to articulate why. That's not mysticism. It's the result of massive exposure to patterns in that domain.
The radiologist who glances at an X-ray and immediately sees the anomaly.
And that kind of intuition is incredibly valuable. It's also fragile. It doesn't transfer to other domains. The radiologist's intuition about X-rays tells them nothing about, say, financial markets. But within their domain, it's a superpower.
The generalist doesn't have that.
Not to the same degree. The generalist might know a little about a lot of things, but they don't have the deep pattern recognition in any one domain. They can connect across domains, but they might miss the subtle anomaly within a domain that the specialist catches immediately.
It's complementary. The specialist catches things the generalist misses, and vice versa.
And this is why the best teams have both. The specialist provides the deep intuition and the anomaly detection. The generalist provides the cross-domain connection and the reframing. Together, they cover each other's blind spots.
That's a satisfying conclusion. But I want to complicate it slightly. What about the person who is both? The specialist-generalist hybrid?
They exist, but they're rare. It's hard to develop deep intuition in multiple domains because the time investment is so large. Most people who claim to be both are actually generalists who overestimate their depth, or specialists who overestimate their breadth.
The T-shaped person, deep in one area, broad across many, seems like the more realistic ideal.
The T-shaped model is probably the sweet spot for most knowledge workers. Go deep enough in one thing to know what real expertise feels like, and broad enough across other things to make connections and communicate across boundaries.
If you're building a team, you probably want a mix of T-shaped people with different deep areas, plus maybe a few pure generalists and a few pure specialists.
The pure specialists are increasingly rare in most fields, honestly. The world is too interconnected. Even the most focused researcher has to collaborate, has to communicate, has to understand something about adjacent fields. The pure specialist who works in total isolation is mostly a myth at this point.
Or a luxury that only a few institutions can afford.
Places like the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, they can support the person who just thinks about one thing for decades. But that's an unusual model.
To pull this together, the prompt asks two questions. Why are some people more broadly curious? Genetics, neurobiology, early environment, and the dopamine reward system all play a role. Some brains are just wired to find novel information more rewarding. And how do specialists and generalists fit together? They complement each other's cognitive blind spots. Specialists provide depth, intuition, and anomaly detection within a domain. Generalists provide breadth, translation across domains, and the ability to spot connections that specialists miss. The best teams, organizations, and societies find ways to value and integrate both.
That's a clean summary. I'd add just one thing. The point that curiosity itself is one of those rare traits where the individual benefit and the social benefit align almost perfectly. A curious person has a richer inner life, and a society with more curious people produces more innovation, better decisions, and more interesting culture. It's one of the few things where there's really no trade-off.
Unless you're the surgeon who's reading about Roman history when you should be keeping up with the latest surgical techniques.
There's an opportunity cost to breadth. Every hour spent learning about something outside your domain is an hour not spent deepening your expertise. The trick is finding the right balance, and that balance is probably different for different people and different roles.
Which is why the institutional design question matters so much. You can't just tell people be more curious or be more focused. You have to create environments where the right mix emerges naturally.
Reward it appropriately. That's the piece that often gets missed. If your promotion criteria only reward specialized output, you'll get specialization regardless of what your mission statement says about valuing breadth.
The incentives shape the behavior. Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1950s, a single surviving Maya Codex fragment housed in Belize's National Archive preserved the geometric specification for a non-repeating lozenge-based floor tiling that, when fully assembled, produces exactly 17 distinct rotational symmetries, and no scholar has ever found a complete physical example of the pattern installed in any excavated structure.
17 distinct rotational symmetries.
I'm now going to spend the rest of the day wondering what that floor would have looked like.
This has been My Weird Prompts, produced by the irreplaceable Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoyed this, leave us a review. It helps other curious people find the show.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.